Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am here today with Jens Sudikum and Bruegel's Nicolas Poitier, and we are going to talk about Germany. This is the biggest economy in Europe. It has been struggling for the last couple of years, politically and also economically, and yet it is certainly not to be counted out. There are elections coming up very soon, and we are going to talk about its role in Europe, where it's gone, where we're going, and how things could change in the coming year. Jens, would you like to start out by just setting the scene for people in other parts of the world or people who haven't been following all the action for the last year or two?
Yes. Hello, everyone. I'm afraid that I don't have too many good news to convey today because the economic situation in Germany has been pretty bad for the last 5 years. So essentially, we didn't have any economic growth. So we are still on the same level of GDP as in 2019, where other parts of the world have grown substantially. And so this crisis, Germany is falling behind, is essentially becoming a drag also for the European economy. Other European countries are suffering because demand from Germany is so bad at the moment. So, and well, that's the situation. So it's a pretty pessimistic. We had a government failing essentially over economic policy issues. And now we have an election coming up very soon, as you say. And this is going to be really decisive for where the economy will be going for the rest of this year and for the next years. And also politically, where Germany is heading. So we're really, really kind of at a crossroads situation right now.
Can you help us remember who the players are now? Angela Merkel was the chancellor for 16 years, very steady, very stable, very clear leadership role. And her successors were a coalition. I guess it was called the Traffic Light Coalition. Who are the people involved and why did it not work?
Yes, exactly. So in the election 2021, somehow, you know, as big as a surprise, Olaf Scholz turned out to be the winner because basically his campaign was because he was the minister under the Merkel administration. And he himself kind of celebrated as like the reincarnation of Merkel. And that eventually worked out. And he formed this Traffic Light Coalition. It's named because the colors of the three parties, the Social Democrats are red, the Green Party, and then the Liberals, the FDP, they are yellow. And they formed this coalition, and they had a bit of bad luck because the coalition was formed in January 22, and just 1 month afterwards, Vladimir Putin attacked the Ukraine, and we had all the crisis unfolding, the energy crisis. So basically, the whole Traffic Light Coalition was in crisis mode from day one, essentially. There was another crisis moment, which probably was not so much recognized internationally. And that was the three parties, they had very different views on economic policy, especially on fiscal policy, whereas the Social Democrats and the Greens, they're really into, investing, changing the economy, and also using the instrument of public debt to make like a big investment effort in infrastructure and so forth. Whereas the Liberals, they were really fiscally conservative. They were defending the debt brake. So had a very different view, liberal conservative view on economic policies. So at the very beginning, there was kind of a trick how to resolve this puzzle. And there was a bunch of unused funds from the corona pandemic, which were still sitting there. We're talking about like roughly 60 billion euro, which the coalition wanted to use for climate investments. And there was a ruling of our constitutional court that dated back to November 23, which essentially pulled the plug on this plan, right? So essentially they declared the budget for 22 as unconstitutional. And that probably was the beginning of the end of the Traffic Light Coalition, because basically 60 billion and kind of the tricks with the unused Corona funds, they were kind of the glue that held the coalition together. And once this this thing was gone, basically all the differences, the fundamental differences, basically they came across the surface, and there was just no way how then the three parties, which were just so different, could find a compromise without the money. And well, that was probably the end, the beginning of the end. And there were lots of, you know, fights, internal struggles, internal fights, and so forth. And all of that came down. The showdown then was in November 24, where then the government ultimately failed. And the re-elections, the snap elections, were scheduled to take place now in February 23.
That's so interesting. The debt break from the outside is so bizarre because you have a country with a very strong reputation in the markets, a lot of fiscal capacity, and yet a constitutional prohibition on borrowing really much at all, let alone to high levels like we've seen in other European countries. Nicholas, help us understand what it meant for a country that was run by the Christian Democratic Union for 16 years to suddenly have a coalition made up of all of the relatively mainstream parties that weren't the CDU. And now it looks like the big rebellion is going to be going back to the CDU. How is that going to work? And what about some of the more out there parties, like the Alternative for Germany, AfD, and also this new party from Sarah Wagenknecht?
Yeah, first of all, thank you very much for having me, Rebecca. I think I'm part of the generation Merkel. Most of my adult life was in the time of Merkel until Scholz. And I think Merkel was, to the outside, she really projected stability. And this is also why German voters kept re-electing her. But she kind of masked profound change in political system, a really fracturing of the political landscape. Interestingly, might have been with the parliament with just four parties. It's not really clear at this point who will get in, will not get in. We have like a 5% threshold for parties to get in. But there was a big shift between parties, the emergence of new right, the emergence, the rise and the fall of the left, that really reshuffled the system. And if you think back to the last election, there was really a lot of movement. It was not really clear who would be the next chancellor. For the first time, we had a serious contender from the Green Party. We had the CDU candidate that was polling very well, and there was a lot of shuffling. It was really unclear because we don't have the stable dominant parties anymore. Now we seem to be going back a little bit to the past where we have a CDU now polling around 30% that might dominate the government. But this is not the same stability of like party system that we had. And there's a real question of how do you deal with now what sets to be the second biggest party, which is the far right, how that will play out. Now, the questions, of course, it's not just the composition of the parties itself, but we've seen through the entire political system shift to the right. One of the most important topics these days is immigration. Every party is saying they want to limit immigration. We have a shift towards very much a focus on economy, not very much on social issues or labor issues. And on top of all of this, we have basically a sense of despair or a sense of things are not going well and people are retreating to nationalism. So I think overall we see a strong shift to the right. The positive news, in a way, is that actually, given the collapse of the government, there seems to be timid voices, even in the conservatives, that recognize we have to end this debt break because no one wants to govern under these circumstances, including the CDU.
Thanks for that. As we move into the next part of the podcast, this is The Sound of Economics. So I'd like to dig in a little bit to what's happening with Europe's biggest economy. From the outside, from Brussels, which is where Nicholas and I are, there's always been a lot of call on countries with the fiscal room to act, and a lot of call for European solidarity on things like relations with China, unifying an energy grid, moving to renewables. And yet, that doesn't always play out in Germany, which ostensibly is the leader. Jens, you are inside. Tell us what that looks like from where you are.
I mean, the German economy sort of suffered from all the big shocks that hit Europe in the last 4 or 5 years, probably a bit more than others. So when the energy crisis unfolded after the start of the war, I mean, basically, Germany was so much more dependent on Russian gas than most other European countries. So kind of that crisis hit us harder than, say, Spain or Portugal. Then the China issue. I mean, everybody suffers from the crisis that we've seen in China and also from this decoupling that China, in a sense, tries to orchestrate in Beijing. But no other European country is so dependent on China as Germany, right? And so all these crises kind of hit the German economy more. And that probably also explains why we're at the bottom of the list when it comes to growth rates. We're like the slowest growing G7 economy. So that's kind of the external part. And then came all these internal fightings, right? I mean, all the struggles within the traffic light coalition, they led just to fundamental uncertainty. They led to very bad decisions. So to give you one example, we had a subsidy scheme for electric vehicles, for purchasing electric vehicles. That was ended overnight over these budget problems, right? Because after this constitutional court ruling, and basically by setting up the budget for 24, they were in urgent need to cut somewhere. And they decided to cut the subsidy scheme for electric vehicles, with the result that sales for electric vehicles, they plummeted like never before. And this is just one example. So all these internal fightings, they just created so much uncertainty. And that has an effect on the economy as well, because now as inflation is, you know, kind of decreasing, real incomes are increasing. So people have more money in their pockets, yet they don't spend it. Most people really now save money. We have a savings rate as high as in the 1990s, right? Because people are really so uncertain, so freaked out about all these crises that they just hang on to their money, with the result that consumption is not really picking up, and hence investment is not really picking up. So we really need, after the election, some solution to this and some stability, some consumer confidence picking up. That's kind of the only way out of this mess.
Consumer confidence is such an American concept. When we think about Germany, we often think of Mittelstand and the Swabian housewives, these sort of core mid-sized companies and very conservative consumer behavior. What is the German economy, Nicholas? What industries are they? What are they making? What are they doing? Who are they working with?
Internationally, Germany is somewhat of an outlier. So for the advanced economies, there's basically just Japan and South Korea that have a similar dominance of industry still. So the European average industry is about 50% of GDP. For a country like France, is 10%. Germany is 20%, which is internationally quite high. And this is also, a lot of this is driven by the integration of manufacturing with the rest of Europe, where Germany very much benefits from having a lot of somewhat lower income countries around it, where it can source inputs from. And then, of course, a lot of this goes through export, capital goods that are exported to international markets, to countries like China. This is also one of the reasons why Germany is now in such a difficult situation, because basically it doesn't have the kind of American consumer markets, or it hasn't had it yet in the same way. It doesn't have to play the same role. And in particular, also, even though actually 80% of the German economy nowadays is also services, the sluggishness comes from the other 20%. And these 20% are very much geared towards international markets, towards China in particular. They export a lot of capital goods. So the cliche is like this Mittelstand, this medium-sized company that produces some machines that are exported in China, then produce some consumer goods. And given that the Chinese economy itself is not really in a great position right now, it looks pretty bad, this demand has not picked up. And the Bundesbank, for instance, thinks that this is a permanent shock. So this is something where basic demand has gone down permanently. This will not recover. This is partially driven by decreasing demand externally, China, potentially in the future also US, depending on what happens with tariffs. But it's also driven by energy, the energy shock. Germany was very much benefiting from cheap gas from Russia. This is not there anymore. And now you basically, there's a question of where energy intensive industry will go. And this has then repercussions for investment, for instance. We have low capital utilization rates where there's already a lot of factories being built for times when there were more production, where there were more demand, and now basically they have too much capacity, so they will not invest even more. This has implications for labor, where there's labor hoarding. It's not very easy to let go of people in Germany. So you have many workers already. You expect lower demand that also decreases the demand for workers. So this has a lot of repercussions in the general economy, and this is an adjustment that will take time. And then the bad news is that these problems are structural. They, even for 27, the Bundesbank expect not more than 1% of growth. So the medium-term outlook is bad, not just the short-term outlook.
Yes, when we think about adjustment, particularly with wages in Germany, there have been some era-defining shifts there, first with reunification after the end of the Cold War, and then early in Merkel's term, if I remember, there was a big wage adjustment that the Germans then used to pressure other countries in Europe to say, we did it, you need to do it too, in sort of this austerity era. Are we back in that same sort of generational shift? Have we learned any lessons from the previous go-rounds?
Yeah, I think there is a shift now that, I mean, the previous crisis, Germany tended to lecture other economies what they're supposed to do, in particular Greece. So that obviously doesn't work anymore. Now it's kind of other economies maybe lecturing us, right? But, you know, when you mention austerity, I mean, basically also in the upcoming elections, we still have a very strong debate about the fundamental economic concepts, how to tackle this crisis. And there are still many people out there, also many economists, who fundamentally believe that austerity, wage moderation, cutting back social spending and so forth is the way out, right? Is ultimately the solution. Whereas others, including myself, I have to say, is, well, the only solution that I see, also to save German manufacturing, the German export-oriented model, is to really enter a phase of fundamental investment. So from a supply and a demand perspective, from a supply perspective, we just need to modernize. Right? We were great when it came to car manufacturing of combustion engine. Right? Probably no other economy did it better than we, but not when it came to electric vehicles. So we have just not invested enough for the last 15, 20 years. And basically that's one reason why we don't sell any cars in China anymore, because Germany doesn't really have anything good to offer. The only way out is to invest massively into kind of these new business models that have a future. So that's kind of the supply side story. The same with infrastructure, right? I mean, German infrastructure is struggling and we need to repair it. There's just no other way. And that costs a lot of money. But also from a demand perspective, I mean, Niklas was mentioning it. We cannot rely on the Chinese market or the American market to solve our problems like we did in the past. In the past crisis, beginning of the 2000s, basically the German model was saved by demand from China, demand from the U.S., that kind of fueled the current account surplus that Germany had, right? And this just will not work anymore, right? So China will not be willing to be kind of the consumer of last resort for German manufacturing. Neither will be Donald Trump, right? So kind of we need to reshift and rebalance to have like a more internally driven economy in Europe. And the only way to achieve that is to spend much more on investment. So this kind of other, the two concepts out there, I mean, I'm not saying that the supply side view, the liberal conservative view, the structural reforms that they're talking about, we need that as well, right? I mean, we need to cut back bureaucracy. We need to do something about the demographic situation, which is worse in Germany than anywhere else in the world. So we need to have reforms to, for example, give incentives to people to work longer and so forth. But that alone will not be enough. I mean, we need that. Plus, we need an agenda to really have a massive investment effort, both for infrastructure, public investment, but in particular private investment, to kind of renew our business models, right, and renew our industry and make it competitive again. Otherwise, kind of this decline of German manufacturing that we've seen for the last 1 or 2 years, or even more, maybe 5, 6 years, right, will just continue, right? And kind of, for me, this is kind of the recipe to kind of try to get a turnaround, but it will be a very, very difficult journey.
If I may piggyback on that, I very much agree with this assessment. We come out of what we as economists describe as a terms of trade shock. So with the increase in energy prices, suddenly the inputs in our industry became much more expensive. At the same time, our exports had become cheaper. So basically, your margins are squeezed, so you have to become much more efficient. And a lot of the policy emphasis we had in recent years was very much focused on this problem. How can we, with lower margin, with lower basically room for error, how we can make the supply side more efficient? We are now in a different situation where the problem is demand. And if you, there are surveys of manufacturing companies that they say the primary problem they see is actually a lack of demand. And if that situation, if you focus on the, if you focus on basically cutting spending and these kind of things, you suppress demand even more. So basically here, I think there is a bit of a risk that this debate, especially with the debt brake, that a debate that focuses too much on not on creating new demand and investment is, for instance, the way how you can become more efficient and create demand, for instance, for construction and this kind of things, that focusing too much on the fiscal side and basically trying to limit the debt brake that becomes more and more binding at a time where actually external demand is also is getting lower, it would even suppress your growth further.
Jens, you mentioned the last crisis, the euro crisis, and how Germany really lectured many of these other countries, particularly Greece, and at the same time benefited from a weaker euro and was able to ride out the crisis in better shape. Do we run the risk now, as the dollar in the aftermath of the U.S. election is back way up to highs that it hasn't seen in recent years, do we run the risk of learning the wrong lessons from these crises and heading in the wrong direction?
Maybe. I mean, the kind of the recurring theme is, as I said, I mean, many people out there still believe that essentially the same recipe that worked in the euro crisis can be used again, right? Whereas the world has changed fundamentally, right? I believe. So, this is why this election is so important, because economic policy issues have been really, really high up the list, apart from other issues like migration and so forth. But it's really this election will eventually decide which fundamental economic strategy Germany will be pursuing for the next years.
So as we turn to the last section of the podcast, I'd like to look forward to what a new government could do. First of all, how long do we think it'll take to have a new government? How long do coalition talks take in Germany these days?
It's very hard to say. So we are in a bit of an unusual territory. We don't know. And I think I would be very cautious. We have kind of stable polls right now, but the last election was very dynamic. So we had mistakes made by two major candidates that basically meant they went from being the front runner to actually losing the election. And this happens in a matter of weeks. So there could be dynamics around a debate. There could be this kind of things. Right now it looks very stable. I think a lot of voters are also a bit overwhelmed with this just happened to them, basically suddenly an election. But it also depends very much on basically the relative shares of votes we have in the end. It seems most likely that there are two options. It's as the polls stand right now. We are recording this in mid-January. It seems most likely that the CDU will run the government, and then they have the option. They have three options. They have the option to go with the Greens, the Social Democrats, or with the AfD. They are ruling out going with the AfD. I think it's unlikely they will, but I don't think it's we don't know. We have seen firewalls, Brandbauern, as they call it in Germany, have been falling in recent year. So I would not completely rule it out, but it seems rather unlikely to me. But there, it's kind of unclear. And depending on what are the kind of constellations, how the election campaign goes, that then means how the coalition talks go. In Germany, some of them have been very quick, some have been longer. I think it's a matter of months.
And do we expect a clear governing coalition or a minority government, or we just don't know?
No, I don't think we will get a minority government. Of course, all of this comes with the caveat that we're recording mid-January and many things can still happen. I mean, just recall the last election in 21, right? Like 1 or 2 months before the election, the Social Democrats, they were way behind. And then in the last weeks before the election, Olaf Scholz really, really picked up in the polls and eventually won. And he still believes that he can repeat and do it again and basically catch Friedrich Merz on the last meters. As of today, that looks very unlikely, I should say. I think the coalition with the AfD is very, very, very unlikely. I agree with that, at least as of today. My concerns there are really when the next German government, whoever it will be, so I think we will either get a coalition between the CDU and the Greens or between the CDU and the Social Democrats. Probably that scenario is even slightly more likely. But if that new government doesn't perform, then my big concern is the election 2029, right? Because at that point, we can get the AfD coming out on the first place, as we have seen in Austria these days, right? And with all the things that are happening, intellectual interference from Elon Musk and you name it, right? All of this is really kind of creating a pretty chaotic situation. But basically, taking today's numbers of the polls, my best guess would be a coalition between the CDU and the Social Democrats. And if that turns out, then the coalition talks will not last very long because kind of people are already preparing for that scenario. There are lots of internal discussions in Berlin, how to divide the ministries and so forth, and how to find compromises. So I think that could go relatively quickly. The question will be if the compromises are really kind of big enough, and you know, if basically that new coalition will be able and have enough common ground to solve the really fundamental problems that we're having, or if we still try to kind of muddle through. That's my biggest concern, that the next government might still have this tendency, as in the past, to kind of muddle through the problems, you know, and hope things will automatically get better, because this may, at the end of the day, turn out to be a big mistake.
It always seemed to me that Scholz was trying to float above. He didn't get as involved in the European leadership issues as his predecessor, which led to sort of a vacuum in Brussels after the war and at other key moments, the war, I should say, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and its effects on Europe. And then he's focused during his term on things like domestic heat pumps and other sorts of things that haven't seemed to tie into the broader economic concerns. Nicholas, does Germany have a way back to what outsiders might think of as the more relevant issues?
I mean, it is, politics lives from clashes, lives from conflict. So you need to have issues where you can very clear the lines. I think the issue of heat pumps, it is a bit comically, maybe from the outside, why Germans care so much about heat pumps. But I think it was psychologically, it was very pertinent one at the time because it was during the energy crisis. People were already paying much more for heating. And they were feeling now that the Greens come in and they tell them they should even pay more for heating, or they shouldn't, maybe not pay more for heating. Heat pumps are cheaper but than other ways in operation, but they should make big investments. It was also an issue where basically the right could really attack the Greens in particular. I think was less of an issue for the Social Democrats and with the Greens. I think that the damage for Scholz was more that he was not seen as being in control of this conflict. What it was something where which allowed the opposition to say, oh, they are rational, they push you in a corner. The problem with these issues is really that for some of them, for instance, if you take the issue of heat pumps, this heat pump law is actually not that important, because if you talk to any energy a consultant, they always say it's already, like, you can already see that it's more efficient to install a heat pump. No one, if you look at new installations, especially in your homes, they all use alternative energies. And we have a carbon pricing that will come in heat pump. That is EU law, that is not German law. Yet it was very symbolic for this. And I think this is where we see some of these things. It's really kind of flashpoints that are very much symbolic rather than the underlying issue. Very much this muddling through, trying to save the day or get through the day by doing something that is very visible. We saw this, for instance, in industry. There's this big concern about deindustrialization in Germany. And what the German government did was just putting a lot of money for individual projects that don't do very much on the macro aggregate level, but they got a lot of publicity. They got a lot of the Interfactory in Magdeburg, for instance. And this strategy, I don't think it's normal politics. I don't think there's something specific to Germany here. But of course, it means that some of these things were maybe a distraction, and that we might have avoided some of the fundamental issues. I think some of this is permissible given that we were in a very big crisis. But now, given we cannot continue this way. That's very clear to me.
You mentioned areas of conflict. Germany has been at odds with much of the EU in terms of how to approach China recently. How do you see that unfolding, and what are the consequences of that?
German companies are particularly exposed in China, especially the big ones. So we already see from small and medium-sized companies that many of them have retreated from China. They felt not treated fairly. They felt the basic Chinese government were intervening against the interest in favor of Chinese domestic companies. But large German companies still were doing very well. They have local production. They produce local for local often. Especially the automotive manufacturing, but also chemical companies. Companies produce, for instance, construction materials. And all of this business has become much more difficult because, on the one hand, geopolitical tensions. There's this real question of can you still operate an automotive supply chain the way you did in the past, and what are the implications of this? And do we see some kind of some topics of economic decoupling? And we know sort of the U.S. government putting big battery manufacturers, these companies rely on entity lists. They're not sanctions yet, but it is kind of a precursor to that. And that would, of course, make business much more difficult. You also have the just like of Chinese demand. The Chinese market is not what it used to be. The growth rates will not come back to there. I'm personally very skeptical of the growth rates that are even reported right now. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that these are not reflective of what's happened on the ground, and that's a big problem. What are the basic returns on these investments, and who else you want to sell to? There's not many markets of this size. There's some hope for India. India is not nearly the size of China as an economy today, so I don't think that works. I mean, India is a market that has a lot of potential, but it is not there yet. And I think that's a big question for these companies.
Jens, what do you think?
Well, I mean, when it comes to kind of the major conflicts, I mean, when I think of the election coming up and the scenarios that will come afterwards, I think there are two possibilities, the optimistic and the pessimistic scenario. So the pessimistic scenario is the next government, whoever it will be, black-green or black-red, so CDU with the Greens or CDU with the Social Democrats, that they will just muddle through and underperform like the previous government, and then Germany will basically decline further. But let me talk about the optimistic scenario, because I tend to be an optimist. I think ultimately we will need something that I would call a grand bargain, right? So a big reform package consisting of many structural reforms from the conservative side, including migration issue, including the social spending part, right? So basically cutting back the welfare state. We had lots of debates about the so-called Bürgergeld, and the CDU was really pressuring to cut back these types of social spendings. And that will be one part of the reform. And the other part will be a form of the debt brake to really initiate a big investment agenda. And I think you need both pieces of the puzzle. And I hope that politicians will actually recognize this. And I mean, when it comes to this debt brake reform, that they really do something substantial. Because my concern on the pessimistic side would be that, yes, there will be a reform, but something that's just too small and doesn't solve any problem out there. I think, I mean, since the debt brake is in the Constitution, now there is a window of opportunity to change the Constitution, which requires a two-third majority, right? And so if you have this opportunity, you better do it right? You don't better waste this opportunity and then come up with a reform that's just too small and insufficient. So, but my optimistic perspective would be that people really understand the situation, the fundamental crisis that Germany is in. We've talked about it. And they really hear the bell and have a big reform of the debt brake, maybe set up a special purpose fund of something in excess of 500, 600 billion to really have the fiscal space for investment for the next 5 to 10 years, and combine that with deep structural reforms, cut back bureaucracy, resolve the immigration issue, so forth. And then if that works out, maybe Germany will be in a much better shape 2 years down the road, and I hope it will.
How will Germany attract the mix of private investment and, of course, public spending that you just referred to and getting around the debt brake? But what are the odds of getting those forces working together to find the money to do all these things we've discussed are needed.
Yeah, I think finding the money is not the key problem. As you said, I mean, Germany has the lowest debt ratio from all G7 economies, so there's ample fiscal space. I think Germany could also act under the EU fiscal rules, because some people are out there claiming that even if we get rid of the debt brake, there's still the EU fiscal rules that kind of hold us back. But I think that's not true. So if Germany is willing to act, I think Brussels would be very happy about that. So I think the fiscal space is not the problem. It's really about finding the right mix and the right instruments to really push investment. So when it comes to public investment, that's probably the easier part. The harder problem is the private investment part, to really incentivize firms to invest more in Europe, in Germany. And there have been some debates about which instruments are best. So the CDU prefers just tax cuts, corporate tax rates, to decrease corporate tax rates, whereas the Social Democrats and the Greens, they think more in terms of tax credits, very much like in the US. So the tax credits from the Inflation Reduction Act. So a firm that invests €1 will get a tax credit of maybe 10 cents, 15 cents. So it's ultimately like a tax cut, but a tax cut only for firms that actually invest and not for all firms. So I think these will be the debates kind of on the technocratic level, which instrument to use. But both of them would kind of cost a lot of money, right, in terms of kind of foregone tax earnings from the government. So both of them require a sufficient reform of fiscal rules of the debt brake. And again, my hope is that in the CDU, I mean, the serious people there know that, and they've understood it. They didn't talk about it in the election campaign. And politically, probably it's wise for them not to kind of promise a big debt brake reform. But ultimately, I mean, my expectation is the minute that Friedrich Merz enters the chancellery, he will understand that basically there's just no other way than to have a sensible reform of the debt brake and of fiscal rules more generally.
Yeah, I think that. I mean, it's not fun to govern with no funds, right? I think just from that. Yeah, I think one of the big challenges going forward, and I think this is a challenge in any economy, but especially in an economy that faces structural adjustment pressure, is how much do you preserve existing structures and how much do you open new opportunities? And these two things are somewhat in conflict with each other. So in the last years, we've seen a lot of emphasis trying to maintain existing energy-intensive industries, giving a lot of money to car manufacturers. And it's not super clear, or it seems quite obvious that many of these industries will not be sustained in the same way they exist today. And that's the reality that the German economy will have to face. And that's nothing new. We have seen this in the past. We have other industries have also declined in employment and investment. Though on the one hand, we will need money to cushion that, to basically make that transition, that green transition. That's not just driven by green transition, but also by the energy crisis. We would make that political palpable, that this doesn't lead to a political backlash to the far right and the far left. But at the same time, you need to have funds to create new investment and create new industries of the future by supporting R&D and these kind of things. And this balance, I think, is one of the key issues that I see for going forward. I haven't seen much debate on that in particular. I think there the concepts are not that different. Generally, I feel there's a bit of a conservative mood. So we are in a crisis moment. So the emphasis is very much on preserving what is there rather than thinking about new ideas and how to open up. But I think eventually that will have to be one of the big challenges in the next mandate.
As we wrap up this podcast, do each of you have any thing you would like non-Germans to know about Germany or understand as this moves forward?
Oh my God, that's the hardest question at the very end. We talked about the Euro crisis and how Germany was lecturing others. And I mean, that probably didn't do well for the reputation that Germany had in many parts of the world. And so now, basically, the lecturer from the past now has big problems on his own. So my problem is kind of, don't engage in Schadenfreude, be gentle. So here also the big guy from the past eventually get around into problems, and that's where we are.
I think for me, I mean, there's of course the whole big economic questions. I think one thing that I see is often misrepresented in the international media. I think Germany is more stable than we give it credit for. Germany has a lot of checks and balances in its constitution and in the institutional setups. There is a lot of requirements for parties to make compromises. And they also have like different levels of general governments checking each other. So I think there's a lot of anxiety about far-right populism and the rise of people like Donald Trump. We see a rise of far-right populism in Germany. It will not be in government. It seems very unlikely to me. So I think there, I think, yeah, we have a shift to the right, especially also in policy, including from establishment parties. But a scenario like Austria seems maybe, in, as Jens were saying, maybe in 5 years, but I think today it's not in the cards just yet.
Thank you both so much for spending this time demystifying Germany, which is such an important economy for Europe and for the world and is going through such big changes and which, frankly, the rest of us need to understand better. This has been The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. We have economics professor Jens Sudikam, who has joined us from Germany, Bruegel's own Nicolas Poitier here in Brussels. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. Thank you so much for listening. You can find all of our Germany-related and other events and reports and research on our website, Bruegel.org, and this podcast on all your favorite podcast channels. Thanks, and see you next time.